From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. This week, more fighting in Libya, how the crisis there is affecting Egypt, Syrian refugees in Turkey, the Eurozone in crisis, and victory for a village in Indonesia 64 years late. We begin this podcast in the hometown of ousted Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. It's called Sirte, and it's on the Mediterranean coast east of Tripoli, the Libyan capital. Anti-Gaddafi fighters now control most of Sirte, but the battle there has been one of the bloodiest of the Libyan war, with civilians caught in the middle amid accusations of brutality by both sides. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro was in Sirte this week, and she filed this report. Please be warned, it contains graphic accounts.
The sickly sweet smell of death wafts over this area of farmhouses, the scene of raging firefights.
We're on the very front lines of the battle here, and as the rebels have moved forward, they've made gruesome discoveries. Right in front of me is one of the three massacre sites that they've uncovered, and the bodies are swarming with flies. They're bloated with death. But what is really striking here is that they were clearly executed. Many of these men were executed while on their knees. They are face down in the ground with their hands tied behind their backs.
About 4 days ago, actually, they were killed, yeah.
Fighter Ahmed Juma points to another site down a dirt road where more bodies are strewn around a yard. They also appear to have been there for several days, indicating Gaddafi loyalists killed them. They're all dressed in civilian clothing, and they're all men. The two sites have about 25 bodies in total. Juma says all those killed here were civilians. It was hard to know exactly what happened.
This is a massacre, really. It's really horrible.
But it's not only Gaddafi's fighters who are being accused of targeting civilians in Sirte. In another neighborhood, anti-Gaddafi fighters are pounding the last few loyalist positions. The fighting is taking place in a residential area, and the Transitional National Council forces are hitting it with everything they have. Black smoke billows in the air. Sirte is burning. Fighter Abu Bakr Hamid says Sirte was given everything by Gaddafi. Everyone else was treated like second or third class citizens. The loyalists here have raped and killed and robbed us, and that's why we must finish this, he says. They are close to doing that, but it's come at a high cost for the people of Sirte. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have both released reports accusing TNC fighters of targeting civilians in Sirte and dealing harshly with suspected loyalists, including using torture to extract confessions. On the side of the road, a group of women and men from Sudan huddle together. They have just fled their homes in Sirte and describe vicious battles and despair.
No food, no light, no anything.
That's Safa Sultan. She says she and her family have been hiding in a basement, afraid to come out. She says they've been surviving on dried goods like pasta and rice. Continuing in Arabic, she says there was no gas to fuel her car, and so she was trapped because none of those fleeing would help take them out. Sub-Saharan Africans are among the most vulnerable here. They've been attacked and their women raped because of fears of being suspected mercenaries in Libya. Safa says she doesn't know what will happen to them now. At another checkpoint, Libyan Farad Lawayed is with 13 members of his family, stuffed into two cars. They siphoned just enough gas to get them out of Sirte. He says a few days ago, 20 families tried to flee Sirte, but Gaddafi's loyalists shot at them, killing one man and injuring another. They were all forced to go back. It's terrifying, he says. All the streets are empty and there is shooting everywhere. But it's not clear what kind of reception they'll get in other parts of Libya. The city of Misrata, which is the closest urban center to Sirte, is not allowing those fleeing the fighting to seek refuge there. The people of Sirte garner little sympathy. They are seen as having benefited from Gaddafi's largesse. their cars laden with belongings. Dozens of people at a checkpoint wait to be processed just outside Misrata. Men hand over their IDs and their names are checked in a database of suspected loyalists. This fighter from Misrata says they have 10,000 names on the list of people who will be arrested if found. If the Sirte residents are cleared, those who don't have friends or family in the area are put in a convoy and escorted under armed guard through Misrata and deposited on the other side of the city, barred from turning back. Many of the Sirte residents don't know where they'll end up or when, if ever, they will be able to return to their homes. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
Libya is awash in weapons these days, and increasingly, smugglers are buying weapons there and transporting them across the border into Egypt, especially to the Sinai Peninsula. The Sinai has become a major security headache for Egypt's military rulers since the popular uprising that ousted Hosni Mubarak 8 months ago. Gunmen crossed the border into Israel in August and killed 8 civilians there. In northern Sinai, there have been repeated attacks on natural gas pipelines feeding Jordan and Israel. NPR's Soraya Sarhadi Nelson recently traveled to northern Sinai, and she sent this report.
Just about everyone is said to own a gun here in the city of Al-Arish. Resident Khalid Saad explains they have little choice, given that the police have largely disappeared from northern Sinai since the uprising in February.
Once they don't see any policemen in the streets, and they start to feel like they're protecting themselves.
He and others say weapons are easy to come by since the revolution in Egypt and subsequent rebellion in Libya. The chaos eroded border security, allowing everything from Libyan handguns to heavy artillery to pour into Egypt. While the military has strengthened its presence in Sinai and conducted raids to try and restore law and order, gun owners say the soldiers have pretty much left them alone. One arms dealer NPR interviewed claims there are stockpiles of weapons in private warehouses across northern Sinai. Saad adds it's not just handguns or rifles that people are buying to protect their families. 2 months ago, his 28-year-old friend Walid, who owns a construction company, bought a 14.5-millimeter anti-aircraft gun smuggled in from Libya for $15,000. He has a picture of it on his cell phone. Saad laughs when asked if it worries him that Walid has an anti-aircraft gun.
No, me and Walid are friends. I don't think that he will kill me anyone when he sees me. How you do that?
Well, friends,
I have my guns, yeah. So what? And if he, I have the same, yeah.
You have a gun too?
Yeah, of course. Everybody have a gun.
But outside Al-Arish, some of the Bedouin tribes have a more sinister motive for their weapons purchases. Local arms dealer Abu Ahmed claims tribes are stockpiling weapons to use against the Egyptian police should they return and resume harassing northern Sinai residents, as they did for years under Mubarak's rule. Abu Ahmed and many others are wanted men facing prison terms. He says they fear Egyptian authorities might go after them the way Muammar Gaddafi went after the rebels in Libya, and they want to be prepared. He and others interviewed say some of the guns are being used by the Bedouin to enforce their tribal system of justice. Recently, outside the Egyptian border town of Rafah, men from one tribe were seen blocking the main road. A Bedouin journalist working with NPR explains the men were looking to carjack vehicles belonging to the members of a rival tribe. Bedouins like Fayez Aid and Ali Madan say they have bought Kalashnikovs to work as security guards for the natural gas pipeline that has come under attack. They say ideally no one would have weapons here, but Madan adds that at the moment no one has a choice.
All are afraid and everyone is trying to secure himself. Anyone who has a factory or a company and has money will buy a weapon to protect himself. Anyone who has a car wants a weapon to protect himself from thugs. There's a high demand for weapons and they are high in price.
Others interviewed say the way to solve this problem is for the Egyptian government to stop looking at Sinai as a security issue and instead bring development and jobs to the region. Nisma Nashat Rifai, a 27-year-old lawyer with the Sinai Youth Movement, says her group and others have formed a coalition to pressure the Egyptian government to hire locally. Meanwhile, Egyptian and Western officials have expressed concern that violent Islamist groups are proliferating in Sinai, a claim all residents interviewed for the story vehemently denied. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News.
As unrest in Syria boils, more than 7,500 Syrians have taken refuge in camps in southeastern Turkey, and Syrians say more would come if they could get past the Syrian army. Media access to the camps has been tightly restricted by Turkey, but NPR's Peter Kenyon was allowed into one of the camps this week, and he sent this report.
Deep in the farm fields of Turkey's Hatay province, young Syrian boys sit at desks inside a large tent and gamely try to get their tongues around some Turkish phrases. The Altınözü camp is sweltering under the sun of a Turkish Indian summer. The camp appears to be well planned and well run, right down to the asphalt laid between the rows of white tents. The pavement may be brutally hot today, but come the winter rains, it'll keep the camp from turning into a muddy swamp. Such foresight is seen as necessary as the Syrian uprising stretches into another season with no sign of resolution. Turkey says there are 1,300 people here, with more than 6,000 others in six additional camps scattered across the countryside. All the Syrians who spoke for this story used partial or false names to protect against retaliation later. Refugee Abdul Razak says he lost four family members when the army attacked his town, Jisr al-Shughur. When asked what Syrians need now, he said international help.
God willing, there will be protection. We need help from the foreigners, from the Arabs. We need a no-fly zone because the regime is using its planes and helicopters to destroy us. Where is the help?
Outside another tent, Ferdana, a tall woman from Latakia, sits next to a relative smoking tobacco from a water pipe. She says many other families are hiding in the mountains of northern Syria, hoping for a chance to cross. She taps a reporter on the shoulder and asks if she'll be heard in America.
We are begging you to just stop this regime of Bashar al-Assad. He is killing us. The people are forced to hide or go to another country. He doesn't understand anything but killing. We don't want to be refugees. We want to go home. So please, just stop him.
A row of men with push brooms sweeps the street in another corner of the camp, where a mock graveyard has been built to ridicule the seemingly moribund international stance towards Syria. A grave has been dug for Russia and China to mark their veto of the latest UN Security Council resolution, and a nearby headstone denotes the political demise of the Arab League. But Razwan, a Syrian lawyer in the camp, is only too aware that the international rescue for the Libyan rebels followed strong action by the Arab League, the UN, and others.
We don't put our hopes in the Arab leaders. They acted against Gaddafi because he's not normal. They don't like him anyway. And we can't ignore that the international community wanted to intervene in Libya because it has valuable oil resources. We don't have that, so they don't help us.
In another of the broiling classroom tents, this one lined with computers, a student who gives her name as Amal recounts how two of her brothers were killed and another arrested before she fled to Turkey. Amal says she wants to go to university in Damascus to study law and international relations. At the moment, though, she finds herself writing poems.
ترحل الطيور الجميلة بحثا عن الأمان والغذاء وها نحن هنا رحلنا من سورية الحبيبة.
The pretty birds migrate from place to place, she recites, searching for food and a safe shore. And so have we become, flying from our lovely land to Turkey. I dream every day of coming home to kiss the sand and feel the flag brush across my face. Right now, that day seems far off. Just down the road, another camp has been built, waiting for the next wave of refugees. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, in the Altınözü camp, southeastern Turkey.
Coming up, a look at the Eurozone crisis from the perspective of its smallest member, and justice for some Indonesian villagers 64 years after a massacre. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. The crisis in the Eurozone is picking up pace. International pressure is growing on Europe's leaders to do something, and to do it soon. Yet EU leaders delayed an upcoming summit to discuss the crisis by almost a week. The head of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, says there's a total lack of vision among Europe's leaders. as NPR's Philip Reeves reports, is not as easy for Europe's politicians to act as it sounds.
Here, the Eurozone crisis seems as remote as the moon. This is Malta, an ochre-coloured cluster of islands in the middle of the Mediterranean. In the capital, Valletta, tourists wander through the old sandstone palaces and Baroque churches and gather on a warm, windy afternoon to watch the dancing fountains. Malta's tiny, about a tenth of the size of Rhode Island. You can drive its widest part, coast to coast, in under an hour. Malta's been an independent nation for less than half a century. Before that, pretty much everyone in the neighbourhood took a turn at ruling it. From Knights of the Crusades to
Romans, Arabs, Turks, Greeks, France, English. We took some of their cultures and habits, and now finally we have our culture, you know.
Jessica Falzon's sitting under some cedar trees, sheltering from the sun. She and her friends are taking a break from classes at the University of Malta. Malta only joined the euro in 2008, tying the fate of its 400,000 people to more than 300 million in a single currency zone now in deep trouble. The president of the European Commission's just warned that Europe's young people face a baptism of fire. Yet here, and in some other parts of Europe too, no one seems terribly worried.
I guess it hasn't affected Malta yet as much, as now we're just seeing on the news other countries, you know, battling and so on.
That's Darcel Falzon, who's 22.
There's always that risk of not finding a job, ultimately, and in Malta being such a small country, it's even worse. But, I mean, all you can do is just study and then whatever happens will happen.
Malta's parliament yesterday finally voted in favour of a much bigger European bailout fund. It also agreed that Malta can make extra loans to stricken Greece, a nation some 30 times its size. Falzon's philosophical about that too, as she thinks right now Eurozone nations need to support each other.
Because today it's you, tomorrow it would be us who would need help, so I think it's a good thing.
Step inside the university, a few yards away, and meet Professor Roderick Pace, an expert on the European Union. Patch is in no doubt about the severity of the trouble now brewing.
I think it is a very huge crisis historically, which should not be underestimated.
Patchy thinks the solution is political.
The political leadership in Europe has to show that it has the heart, the strength, the leadership to lead Europe out of this crisis.
That has not happened so far. The international community, including the US, is increasingly frustrated with Europe's leaders who are seen as posturing and dithering. Only yesterday, EU leaders decided to delay a potentially crucial summit by about a week. It's widely believed to survive, the Eurozone must create a much deeper political union. That'll be at the expense of some of the sovereignty of its 17 nations. The people of these streets in Malta waited centuries for sovereignty. You'd think they'd hate parting with even the smallest grain of it. But Darcel Falzon thinks you can integrate politically without losing all that much.
Nowadays, not just in the Eurozone. I mean, the world has become a global village, right? So it's the whole world who's actually moving in that direction. We stand as Malta. We remain Malta, I believe. I hope so.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, Malta.
In Indonesia, many people are celebrating what they see as a long-delayed victory for justice and human rights. Representatives of a village whose menfolk were massacred by Dutch colonial soldiers 64 years ago sued the Dutch government and won. The court ruled that the government must now compensate the victims' seven surviving widows. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports from Jakarta about the case and why the widows got no help from the Indonesian government.
84-year-old Chawi Binti Baisan remembers her husband Bital waking her up before dawn one morning in 1947. Bital went by only one name, and he had just come in from the rice paddies carrying his plow.
Wake up, he said. Many wives were still asleep. What is it, I asked. There are many Dutch troops at the irrigation ditches, he replied. We're already surrounded.
Indonesia declared its independence in 1945, but for four more years, the Dutch fought to hang on to their former colony known as the Dutch East Indies. On December 9, 1947, Dutch troops came to Rawagede village in West Java looking for an insurgent leader. The villagers said they had no idea where he was, but the soldiers suspected the villagers were aiding the insurgents. Chawi mimics the sound of gunfire she heard as the soldiers summarily executed all male villagers aged 14 or over. She squats beside Bital's grave next to those of 180 other massacre victims in Rawagadai. Villagers say the rest of the remains of the more than 400 massacre victims are missing. Chawi's lips quaver as she recalls finding her husband that afternoon shot to death in a ditch.
People searched for bodies like this. Where is my brother? Where is my husband? Like this, like people looking for small fish in a ditch. The surviving men all ran for their lives. For a month, there was not one man in this village.
The massacre would likely have faded into history were it not for the lawsuit, which was filed 3 years ago by village representatives and others who were unwilling to let such an injustice go unchallenged. There's a 5-year statute of limitations for a civil suit under Dutch law. Officials reminded Lisbeth Zegveld of this, but the Amsterdam lawyer who represented the victims' widows shot back.
I know, but you also know that you're still dealing with the claims of Jewish relatives that suffered damage in the Second World War. So you do still take up claims from that period.
Dutch opposition lawmakers supported the lawsuit. They argued that if the Netherlands aspires to be the international capital of justice, then it had better be able to take a dose of its own medicine. In fact, the Dutch government long ago admitted to the killings and donated money to the village of Rawagadai. Zegveld says that a lawsuit could have been avoided if the Dutch had just linked that payment to the massacre, but they refused.
It acknowledged from the first day that crimes had been committed, and then they remained silent for the next 60 years.
How much compensation the widows will now receive has not yet been determined. War crimes victims suing perpetrators in court is a fairly recent development. Traditionally, such matters have been settled between governments. But Jakarta has avoided any involvement in the Rawagadai massacre case. Haris Azhar is a human rights advocate with a group called the Commission for the Disappeared and Victims of Violence. He says that the government wants to avoid responsibility for atrocities committed in the post-colonial era.
There were many similar cases like Rawagadai. Hundreds of people or even thousands of people being persecuted, killed, targeted for torture. Many human rights violations, but unfortunately, no accountability has been taken.
It's been more than a decade since the fall of the military dictator Suharto, Harris says, but his culture of impunity for past human rights violations lives on. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Jakarta.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.